the Not Alone podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And he's despondent.
This is who I am now.
It happens.
We're about to enter the infinite.
Yes. To know the unknowable.
Which in its own doesn't make any sense. So,
correct.
We'll go from there.
That's
anyway,
fair.
We just recently wrapped up talking about young Aleister Crowley's...
Crowley.
If you say Crowley and I say Crowley, wouldn't that mean
Crowley.
Together we have it correct?
Yeah.
One way or another.
Yeah, no. Yeah. No, because I do know the correct way of saying it, and it is Crowley.
Okay. Anyway, so now we're about to find out what Crowley is about to do with the wealth that he just acquired. And new pursuits, I'm assuming, correct?
Yes. So if you haven't listened to last episode, go listen to it.
And I'm also assuming that we're jumping back into the...
Crowley zone?
I was going to say Rosicrucianism.
Oh, yeah. That was what we teased at the end of the last episode. Rosicrucianism. So basically...
Which is a big word that I don't know.
Yeah, well, you're about to. You're about to know it better than you wish you ever had.
I have a feeling that I already do.
Basically... What happened is that Crowley drank deeply from the Fountain of Mystery and had all sorts
of
ideas.
Is that a chocolate fountain?
Yes. All sorts of ideas swirling around his mind. And then they were focused by an idea, an occultic system known as Rosicrucianism. Now, again, he discovered this term firstly in the work of Arthur Edward Wait.
Things are going to get weird this episode, aren't they?
They already are.
Perfect.
Wait was a noted occultist who attempted to create basically a history of Western occultism, and he turned Crowley on to the fact, the idea, the system of Rosicrucianism, which we're now going to tell you what that means, so you don't have to go read a lot of books about it. Isn't 2020 amazing?
It's okay.
It's so good. Rosicrucianism is one of
what
the...
What part?
None of it, actually.
Oh, okay.
Rosicrucianism...
I got confused.
Rosicrucianism is one of the OG secret societies of the post-Reformation world. Theoretically, the story goes that some man named Christian Rosenkreuz was a doctor, living sometime between the 12th and 15th centuries. Rosenkreuz was said to be an extremely pious doctor who spent his life wandering the world in search of capital T truth, trying to find it among the Christian mystics, the Muslim Sufis, and the Jewish Kabbalists. Now, after learning and assimilating all of their knowledge, along with a little help from the Lord God Almighty, Rosenkreuz established a philosophical, magical, religious system which would bear his name, Rosicrucianism, and its adherents would be called Rosicrucians. Now, Rosicrucianism constitutes a hidden reality, a set of initiates who reside in normal, real society, unable to reveal their true identity to anyone other than the worthy. According to an author named Manly P. Hall...
Sam, how many times have you been able to actually keep a secret?
Never.
Wow, these people are better than us.
Not once. How about you? How many secrets do you have?
I can't tell.
Because there's too many of them, or you're just good at keeping secrets?
Who's to say?
Here's a little secret. Don't tell me anything, because I will tell everyone everything.
You want the gossip to reign supreme.
I live on a steady diet of tea. Please.
And The Bachelor.
Exactly. That's why. They're basically the same thing. The Bachelor is just televised gossip is all it is.
Yeah, that's all.
It's fantastic. It's
just televised gossip and drama.
Yep.
It's beautiful.
Now, according to Manly P. Hall, who wrote the book The Secret Teachings of All Ages, which is a handbook on Hermeticism, occultism, and magical ritual, Rosicrucianism is the pure, unadulterated truth that lies behind all of the false teachings of the world. It is the nucleus of wisdom and godly revelation that resides at the heart of a perverted and wicked reality.
Interesting. It's a religion base that thinks that it's better than all the others and everything else is wrong.
No.
Sort of?
No, not necessarily.
Kind of.
That puts that would put Rosicrucianism on the same, like, just spatially, like, level-wise, they're on the same, like, level. Even if this one's, like, a little bit higher, they're all in a straight line, even
of
if the line
what,
goes up and down.
What's the graph?
I don't know. Of truth. Rosicrucian.
Truth, capital T.
No.
Truth.
Yeah. Rosicrucianism isn't like that because it is the interior center around which everything else revolves.
Right. So it's giving itself dominance over the others.
Right. But people who think, for instance, people who think that one religion is true and the other religion is false, do not say that the religion that's false stole from them. I mean, sometimes they do. But rather, they just say, we're not related. That's not true. I am true. Rosicrucianism says that all of the religions, literally all of them, or at least all of the Abrahamic religions, take from it.
Right.
It is the source, the well of these things. So it's not that it's
thus
better.
Being better.
It's not that it's better.
It is the one it's that supplies not... the information, the knowledge. So in turn, it is the
it's
one that is higher than the others.
It's not being better, I don't think. Maybe it is.
It's like a uniformed theory of truth. Would that be of mystical teachings?
Yeah.
Would that be more accurate?
Yeah, maybe.
It's the society that...
It is the center of mystical knowledge. And all other religious thought comes to that center, receives from it, and takes out into the world. But that's what I'm saying is that Rosicrucianism wouldn't say that any such religion is false. It is simply that they are not completely true.
So they're ignorant to some degree.
They're not ignorant because they were ignorant before they came and received their knowledge. They just don't have everything. Rosicrucianism is everything. It's not even that it has everything.
So the lights are partially on.
It would be different if Rosicrucian... Yeah. No, that's good. Yeah.
So,
the lights are partially on, and the only
so it's
light...
kind of like...
Rosicrucianism is the power plant.
Uh-huh.
And religions are my house.
Okay.
I have all sorts of different sources of light here. They all come from the power plant. But if I was to go immerse myself in the source of these things, I would die. I would be destroyed. Because I can't bathe in electricity.
Have you tried?
No. But they tried it with Crowley's father and it didn't work. So
different kind of electricity.
That's true.
That's from plants.
Plant
remember?
Electricity. True. Anything else?
Plants work more like hydraulics, but whatever.
Any case, so Rosicrucianism is the source of all knowledge. Because
gotcha.
Rosicrucianism...
But what about Hermeticism?
Hermeticism grows, theoretically, in this view, out of Rosicrucianism.
That's not what Hermeticism says, right?
No, it's not.
You get what I'm saying?
I guess. But I still feel like...
It's establishing a new hierarchy.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I think of it as Russian nesting dolls is what I just realized that I'm envisioning in my head.
It's, yeah.
And
well,
when you peel back all of them at the middle of it, at the center, when you open the last nesting doll that doesn't have one within it, what's actually within it is
a
Rosicrucianism.
Got
yeah.
it. Okay.
Rosicrucianism has been hailed as the source of a number of secret societies and hermetic traditions throughout the centuries, including that organization which gave Crowley a taste of true occultic practice, the Golden Dawn, which we'll return to in just a few minutes. However,
I feel like they have robes that have like gold accents on
yep,
them and
you're right.
some sort of sun.
You felt your way to the truth.
Yeah.
Look at that.
I've watched enough television to know better.
Now, all of these orders, Golden Dawn included, according to Hall and other researchers, are simply distractions. Like I was just saying, basically they go and they get the light. Because it is light,
it travels faster than them.
Nope.
Oh,
that
okay.
would technically be true. But it's not the case in the metaphor here. Because it is truth, it necessitates...
So what you're telling me is truth is a wave?
Or a particle. Or both at the same time.
Not if we try to observe it.
No, that'll change which one it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I understand.
Perfect. I'm done. I'm sorry.
Are you and are you? I think it's
yes
no
and probably
to both
no.
of those. And I don't want it to be yes to either of them. So they get truth. They get a little nugget of truth. Because it is pure, unadulterated truth, the source of all things in the universe, even if it's just the tiniest amount, it necessarily establishes rituals, thoughts, belief systems around it, because we cannot comprehend simply truth. We can only comprehend truth through form. That'll come back in the Kabbalah stuff.
Cool.
So don't worry about that. We'll get more into that as well.
Sweet.
So basically the way that this works then is you have two orders of Rosicrucianism. The inner order is that which is basically the guardians and the keepers of the lights, who then give it to the distributors of the lights. Inner circle has the knowledge. Second circle takes that knowledge and either wittingly or unwittingly creates these religious systems around it in order to draw people from outside of the circles into the circle. Good?
Sure.
Okay. That is the gist of what Wait explained to Crowley. So Wait tells Crowley about Rosicrucianism.
Yes.
Tells him to read a book called The Cloud Upon the Sanctuary by an author named Carl von Eckhartson. Okay?
Okay.
In this book, Eckhartson describes what he calls the interior and the exterior churches. The interior church is the group of people who are taught directly by God, who then disseminate those teachings to more common people who, because they are interacting with the direct truth of God, necessarily establish religion and ritual and belief and practices. It's basically the same thing, is the point that's made over and over and over again.
So everything we know is nothing.
We know
very little.
Very, very little.
Very little.
Very, very little. Very little.
And we don't get to know more.
You can know more through a lot of work, like okay. a lot of meditation and
Sam,
stuff.
Sam, is this your ultimate goal?
What? Madness?
No.
Oh, to join the
inner circle?
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course it is. I don't want to go through it like the magical way, but it is essentially like the...
Wait. Oh, okay. Hold on. So I'm assuming...
Yeah.
Hypothetically, there's two roads.
Okay.
The like scholastic way and the magical way.
Not even necessarily.
There's, okay, a third role.
The third way is...
What I'm getting at, through all these doors...
The direct...
You do not choose the magic door.
No, I don't choose the magic
door. Come on!
No, I don't choose the magic door. The direct experience of God. Not the knowledge, not the understanding, not the comprehension, the experience. That's what all of this is going for. Whether it's Rosicrucianism, occultism, Kabbalah, as we'll see, Hermeticism, it's all about the directly experiencing the fullness, or at least whatever we can, of the truth, the transcendent truth that drives the universe. It's
wow.
good stuff.
That's big, man.
It's good stuff.
So anyway, you didn't choose the magic door.
I didn't choose the magic door. No.
As soon as you said no to that, I kind of zoned out.
Quote, this is Eckhartson talking about the interior church. Quote, "This community of light has existed since the first day of the world's creation, and its duration will be to the end of time. It is the society of those elect who know the light and in the darkness and separate what is pure therein. Now the chiefs of the interior church, the elect, then feel an urgency and a need to disseminate these mysteries revealed to them." These are people, these aren't like Bob down the street, nor is it like me. These are people like Moses and whoever, Muhammad and whoever.
Prophets,
I guess Jesus,
essentially.
Probably. Yeah, prophets. They are the people who are the internal church.
So not even like saints or the Pope. These are like another level.
They're the ones
if
who...
If the Pope was over 9,000, then what are we talking
that
about?
Be it. These are the ones who are world changers, who establish...
They're the core of their beliefs.
Exactly. Okay. They are... Exactly. They create... They are the nucleus. but they themselves are but a physical representation of what cannot be seen, which is what Eckartson says here. Regarding all of this, as far as well as the acts that spring up in religion and all of that around such belief systems, he says, quote, "The external church of the ancient alliance was visible. The interior church was always invisible and must be invisible and yet govern all because force and power are alone confided to her," unquote. So you have a visual representation of invisible truth. This is true. This is an archetype that plays heavily into Christianity, where Jesus is the visual representation of the invisible God.
Right.
It plays heavily into Rosicrucianism, where in the second order is the visual representation of the first order.
Mm-hmm.
And it plays very, 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 very explicitly clearly here that Eckartson is talking about these two things as the same thing. Rosicrucianism and religion in general, Christianity specifically, are the same thing. They work the same way.
Okay.
That's his point. So Crowley is drawn into this. He feels the need to commune with what's known as the secret chiefs.
Right, which this also makes sense because he's already kind of denounced the classical way of thinking about his religion.
Exactly. He's already open to the more like esoteric, mystical thoughts. So this final quote from the Cloud Upon the Sanctuary, okay? So this describes these three different ways of existing, ways of understanding, basically. Quote, "The first and lowest degree consists in the moral good, which is the simple will subordinated to God, is led to good by the pure motivation of the will, which is Jesus Christ, received by faith. The means by which the spirit of this school acts are called inspirations. The second degree consists in that rational intellectuality by which the understanding of the man of virtue who is united to God is crowned with wisdom and light of knowledge, and the means which the spirit uses to produce this are called interior illumination." So, really quick, your first and second levels of knowledge come through basically the spirit. Or in Rosicrucianism, it can be the spirit, or it can be the chiefs, or it can be whatever. But a veiled communication.
Okay.
Inspiration or interior illumination. Interior illumination would probably be better understood as like
epiphanies.
Epiphanies, yes, yep. Exactly. Whereas inspiration is just like, oh, yeah, cool, that sounds good. Yeah, I'm just going to not be a dick today. That sounds like a good thing to do. I'm on board. So then the third and highest degree, this is back with the quote, is the entire opening of our inner sensorium by which the inner man attains the objective vision of real and metaphysical verities. This is the highest degree when faith passes into open vision, and the means which the spirit uses to this end are real visions. You are not getting any sort of a message. You are seeing what it is. There is no intermediary between you and the truth at this point. You are approaching the truth and just seeing it.
Visually
it
seeing it.
Okay. Yes. That is what Crowley's going for here. That's what his entire goal is. He reads this book like a dozen times while he's mountain climbing. He devours this. And then because of this, he begins to devour other things like other alchemical texts, Kabbalah, which we're going to talk a lot about here in a few minutes, all sorts of different things.
Okay.
But most importantly, what comes out of this experience is that he makes what he calls a pure act of will, which is when you just will something to happen. That the method by which he does it is very much exactly what we would call prayer, but we can't call it prayer because it's Aleister Crowley and he doesn't pray. He has acts of will. Normal people pray. He wills things to happen because he's Crowley. So right.
He's more powerful.
Exactly.
He's better than the
he's
rest of us.
He's better than me.
Exactly.
That's for sure. So Crowley makes an act of will to the secret chiefs. The secret chiefs, it's not understood who or what or where. We're going to talk more about them in a few episodes. They could be gods. They could be men. They could be neither. They could
be
both.
They're some sort of entity that is...
They're something that has a complete...
Somewhat pulling the strings.
A complete control, yes. So he says to them, he's read this and he's found that the initiates into the outer circle have to share knowledge. They cannot keep it to themselves. So he petitions the secret chiefs directly to draw him to them through these layers of initiation.
Right.
And then nothing happens for months. Whoa. Up until maybe like a year or two. I don't know exactly. None of his autobiographical stuff is like laid out very well chronologically.
Makes sense.
Because he's on drugs all the time.
Yeah, makes sense.
It makes sense. It happens to you, you know. But
I don't know. I have no frame of reference for this, but I'm assuming so.
Good. I'm glad. Basically, after some period of time, Crowley gets discouraged. He's made his act of will.
What?
And in addition to making his act of will,
it
didn't just happen.
Wow.
And in addition to this, he also has been spending lots of time reading Kabbalah, reading alchemy, reading hermetic texts, all of this stuff that we've talked about. He's just immersing himself in it, and he doesn't know why he's not receiving his contact, why he's not being drawn in. So during it's a vacation of some sort. It's either a winter break or a summer break. I want to say.
You mean a holiday?
It's a holiday. He took a holiday, and his holiday was on a glacier, which makes me think it was a winter holiday, but there are places where, glaciers don't, they don't come and go.
Well, I mean, they're going now.
Well, they are going now.
Yeah.
Those were the good old days. I know, we're going on a cruise to Alaska in like a few months. I'm like, I need to see those glaciers.
Ice cubes.
I got to see those glaciers now.
Yeah.
Because they ain't going to be there much longer.
It's just going to be slush. Anyway.
That's sad. He's on a glacier. He gets depressed. You know how it goes. He comes down the glacier, and he decides to get very drunk. As he is drinking a lot, he begins to ramble about alchemy. Crowley is a kind of person who his entire life, he's just the smart one. This happened to me. I was in Gifted and Talented as a kid. GT, mm-hmm. Challenge class, as we called it. I was making robots in like third grade and stuff. I was smart, and I was used to people thinking that. And then once I got out of high school, I realized I'm an idiot. And I just probably guessed the right questions on the test. And I have then not gone and done anything with my life for like 10 straight years.
I'm so proud of you.
So I'm sure there are people who identify with this and understand exactly what I'm saying. Crowley was this person. His equivalent to graduating from high school and then realizing that he's not as smart as he thinks he is and then having to readjust his entire life around it comes at this point in time when he is rambling drunk. He's in the tavern and there's a man there who, instead of agreeing with him about the alchemical principles that he's expounding to these mere mortals, challenges him. And says, no, you're actually quite wrong. That's not
I like
how
him already.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not how this works.
My kind of guy.
The two strike up a conversation. And Crowley learns that this man is named Julian Baker. Julian Baker, in his day job, is an analytical chemist. In his night job.
Oh, boy.
He's an alchemist, baby.
An alchemist, baby?
He's an alchemist, comma, baby.
Oh, okay.
Period.
Got it.
He's an alchemical child. He is doing all of these, and it's not just like what we were talking about with alchemy. It's not just like my whole like spiritual evolution thing. It's like he's like sitting there with acids and like pouring them together and like mixing them and like trying to make it happen. That's who he runs into, and that's who finally bests Crowley, which I think is poetic because like it's a person who is, instead of just reading about things, he's actually doing things.
Right, right.
Whereas Crowley just reads about things.
Regurgitating information, yeah.
Which, again, same problem. Taking me back to high school. But
instead of implementing and performing experiments and creating new information, new knowledge.
I just took what I had to get by, and I did it better than anybody else. But then I realized that's all I could do. And now it's got me cripplingly afraid that I'm going to move and I'm going to go do this whole like intensive college course and realize that I'm just too stupid for it.
That's not the truth.
So we'll see what happens.
All you have to do is regurgitate the information. We just went over that.
True.
And that's one thing you can do.
So.
And if you can't, you're already good at taking tests, remember?
That's true.
It's
that's
one or the
true.
Other.
I did.
So you're pretty much set up for this
whole
college
right.
thing.
You're right. I'm going to be
fine.
Thanks, bud.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. Baker takes Crowley back to their hotel. They were both staying in the same hotel. And they're like talking the whole time. And Crowley he's undergoing like a significant paradigm shift, but it's not until after Baker leaves him that and goes off that Crowley realizes that, oh my gosh, that's the guy. He's the guy. This is my answer. So he goes to sleep like a drunk. And then he wakes up super early in the morning like a drunk. I don't know if that ever happens to
just
you.
Just disheveled? No.
You're just like, oh my God, I'm awake. Oh, this is terrible.
That's never happened.
Oh, it's awful.
That's never happened to me.
It happened to him.
I've always been like, nah.
It happened to him.
And necromancy.
How can I sell part of my soul so I don't have to feel like this anymore? He jumps out of bed. He runs downstairs like a child on Christmas, and he tries to find Baker, only to find that Julian Baker checked out, and he was on his way to the train station.
And can I just say how poetic this is right now?
Oh, I know.
Like, how probably fictional it is. But continue.
I love it.
This is a movie scene.
Crowley, it is a movie scene,
yeah,
because then
100%.
He busts his way out of the...
This
the
is a rom-com.
Whatever. Yeah. He busts his way out of the hotel, and he's like, taxi! Taxi! I don't know if they had taxis back then, or if it was like a goat, because he was on a glacier. Whatever. Take me to the railway station, sir, please. And he did. And then he sees Baker from afar, and he runs to him. And Baker's like, what? What do you want? And Crowley looks him deep in the eyes and says, are you a master? And then Baker gets this really, this kind of this smirk. Yeah, just like that. Just like that. And he says that the honor and rank of master has not been allowed to him. But upon returning to London, he would introduce young Master Crowley to a man who was more of a magician than both of them put together.
I think it's interesting that he points out specifically magician and not alchemist, because from what we've been told from the previous conversation, it was all alchemy based.
Yeah. Alchemy is a part of magic. Magic,
I mean,
is not a part of alchemy.
Yes,
I'm just talking about how this works.
Yeah. But I mean, it's more like a science than a magic.
I completely agree with you and also understand.
But what I'm getting at is, like, I wouldn't refer an alchemist to being a magician.
Right, but they would, because that's what it is. That's how this philosophical, magical, quasi-religious system works.
This makes no
sense
to me.
Is that alchemy... Well, basically, if you think of it back at Hermeticism...
Right.
Remember, we talked about Hermeticism. It has three different components. It has alchemy, astrology, and theurgy.
Yep.
These three things create Hermeticism. And
yes,
it's essentially the same in just magic as well. It's made up of these different components that make up magic. With a K, obviously. So,
okay,
there's that. And that's the thing about these magicians. They were all of them, almost all of them, were like actually very accomplished, very intelligent people. Like, there's multiple of these analytical, industrial chemists. There's some of the brightest,
well,
like,
another,
literary
it's
minds.
It's another puzzle to solve.
It is. The puzzle of being. And how do we make it stop?
I think we know that one. That one's an easy question to answer.
Maybe. Now, they get back to London after, again, a kind of undisclosed period of time. I'm certain I could have drawn a map and figured it out, but it was kind of convoluted. So, they get back to London, and
okay,
Baker introduces Crowley to a man named George Cecil Jones, who is another chemist. But Jones was a magical adept.
Ooh.
Who recognized Crowley's potential as a worker of the arcane arts on site. Which is an interesting thing, because this harkens back to another tradition with another secret society, the Freemasons, which,
right,
as we'll see, are very integral to all of this, because of course they are. Masons had this thing that they would do called, like, master on site or mason on site. And basically, it could take time to work your way up through masonry, and then once you were at the top, if you are of a specific caliber, you are able to just look at people and be like, that guy's a master mason. And he's like, I don't even know what that means, sir. And he's like, doesn't matter. You are. Come on. And then you get inducted into the highest realm right off the bat. It's sick.
Cool.
It's cool. I only know of a few
now,
cases
obviously,
of that
you probably
happening.
Wouldn't do that too free. Yeah, I was going to say, like...
No. I only know of a few cases of it happening, and it's... I'm not going to say who it is, who they are, because they're controversial. We'll talk about it later. Anyway.
Of course we will.
So, he advised, he being, again, George Cecil Jones, advised Crowley not to undertake his magical education alone, and claimed that medieval texts that seemed to be the key to the whole business were actually intentionally obfuscating, and that only a master under the tutelage, or only a student under the tutelage of a master, could decipher them. What does that sound like?
The rule of two.
Yeah. There you go. That works, too.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say alchemy, because that's exactly, but if you want to go all nerdy on it, that's fine, too.
I mean, that's what it sounds like
to
me.
Do you
want to
just remind people what that is?
There is only a master and a pupil.
Of the Sith.
Yeah,
order.
But I
yes.
mean, like, yeah, it's the same thing.
It's kind of the same thing.
And eventually the student will replace the master and thus take an apprentice.
Yes. And the apprentice has to kill the master. That's like, did you read? Yeah, you read the Darth Bane.
I know.
Stuff, right?
I know things.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, guys, it's Sam here with a mid-show break. Sorry about the quality. Basically, long story short, I just don't have access to my microphones right this moment. Packing and timelines and all sorts of stuff are a little weird right now. And yeah, so in any case, this is going to be a pretty quick one, pretty short one. All I really want to do to start is to thank the people who left us iTunes reviews. There's two of them this week. We'd like to thank Stiggins and Iced-T224. We'll read Iced-T224's. They say, just found these guys a few weeks ago and have quickly worked through most of their catalog. The effort they put into researching their chosen topics is usually pretty evident, and between the effort behind the show and the variety of topics covered, this is a great podcast to help long days move just a little bit easier. Thank you so much, Ice-T. Now, I didn't want to just rush through that, but I do have some more things I want to talk about really quick. The first one is we don't have any new patrons this week, which is fine, because here's what I'm thinking. I don't want to be an alarmist, but I am, and that's just who I am. And I've actually had multiple people at this point reach out to me and tell me, hey, I'm an alarmist too, and things are getting pretty scary right now. So what I'm going to do, this is not significant in any sort of major way, but I just figured for the next month, maybe 2 months, what I'm going to do is go ahead and open up the Patreon archives to everybody. I'm going to do that by means of basically going in and changing the permissions for all of our audio posts. And this is everything from our very first bonus episodes back in the day to our more recent bonus episodes, even to the Crowley marathon file. I'm going to open that up for everybody for the next month or two, simply because I think we need distractions. I think we need diversions more than we need anything else other than washing our hands. I think that's the other thing that we need the very most right now. So I know it's not much. I wish I could do more on like a real fundamental level, but if you want to download the Patreon app or go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast for the next month or two, really, I'm just thinking until news of self quarantines and nations getting quarantined. Once that goes away, we'll close back up the Patreon. Yeah, I love you all. Thank you, by the way, to anyone who did buy a sticker. Baron's surgery was today. We were able to cover it entirely through the generosity of people who listen to this podcast, which is amazing. It came out to over, it was hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and we were able to cover it all. And so thank you so much, everybody. You know who you are. Who donated large sums and even people who just bought one sticker. It all means the same. It's all so appreciated and we love you so much. And Baron loves you and he's very, very grateful. We do have a few stickers left over. If anybody is still interested, we'll just use that money for moving to, well, Washington. So we'll see how that goes too. But in any case, guys, we love you. Please stay safe. Download the Patreon app. Go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast if you're interested in listening to those back catalogs. And if there's anything we can do for any of our listeners, let us know. We love you so much. Stay safe out there, guys. We'll be back next week.
So, there is one exception to this rule. One medieval manuscript that is written in such a way as to be accessible for anyone who is interested in learning actual ceremonial magic.
So, what you're telling me is that, for the most part, all knowledge about this stuff is cryptic and incredibly hard to understand. You won't be able to understand it unless you already have a master in which you are learning under. Except for this one book.
Yes. Yeah, other than that one book.
Hey.
Yeah. Exactly.
So we got the DLC code
We've
is what you're telling
DLC
me.
Code.
The
We've
loot
got
box
the
back here.
Because you need to have a starting point, you know? You need to have a starting point because unlike alchemy of the Middle Ages, these people weren't looking to
it's
live.
It's so strange that that book just did not get printed more. Saying that it was the end-all be-all and people would be able to understand it.
The other problem with it is that that book was only
under lock and key.
No, it's not. I downloaded a PDF of it.
So now you are an alchemical master.
No, I didn't want to spend too much time reading it because it gets a little freaky.
But it was written in like perfect language, so everyone can understand.
Yeah, understand how freaky it is.
Okay.
The other problem
this makes more sense.
Up until this point in history is that that book was not available. It was not readable because it was written in a foreign language that was just recently translated by a very great man that we'll talk about later. This book,
hopefully it was translated correctly.
This book was supposedly written in the 1450s. It's called the Book of the Sacred Magic of Abramelin the Mage. It chronicles the meeting of one Abraham, who goes by Abramelin, and another Abraham. The first was Egyptian, and the second was German. The second Abraham, called the Abraham of Worms due to his living in the German town of that name, is telling his son, Lamech, the story of the way that he met the archmage Abramelin and the magic that he learned from him. It was this book that served as Crowley's first magical text that he actually learned from. Around the middle of the book, which is subdivided into three parts, with the first being nothing but narrative, and the second and third being magic, the first actual magical ritual is described, which is what Crowley had been instructed to perform by Jones in order to gain instruction in the magical arts. The ritual is preceded by 6 months of preparation, which includes hours of prayer every day, shutting oneself off from the outside world as much as possible. Finally, after 6 months of penance and preparation, you're ready to summon the divine angels to do your bidding and come face to face with the powers that control the cosmos.
That's all it takes.
That's it. So long as, unlike me, you read the whole thing to the end first. You remember those tests? 55 question tests. The last question says, write your name on the top of this paper and turn it over to receive full credit. And the whole point is that you're supposed to go
read. Sam, I think I know why you assumed you were so smart growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got tests like that, you lucky.
You were supposed to read everything first, and then they would know. This happened to me in college just a month ago. The teacher had an hour-long welcome video, and I was like, I'm simply not watching this. I have better things to do. And they had hit an assignment in the middle of the video, so they knew who watched it or not. I didn't.
Yep.
So, similarly, you need to read the entire book before trying to perform the ritual, because only at the actual, start of the ritual itself are you told
out your fresh child.
Yeah, well, in addition to you being prepared for 6 months, you also have to prepare a child for 6 months to act as a cosmic witness to the event. And if you don't have that, this child, who is no older than the age of 8, who is clothed in white with a golden mark on his head, accompanying you through every step of the journey, whose innocence is the key by which the doors of eternity may be opened, then you just have to start all over again. So
it's all a wash.
It's all a wash.
That's I love how this whole thing comes boils down to really just a few steps, and then you unlock the and gain control over angels.
Well, again,
essentially,
the first 6 months, I actually didn't put much of the ritual in here because this operation of Abramelin, as it's called, is going to be the focus of Crowley's magical life for like the next 2 to 3 years,
yeah.
And he just can't get it off for a while. But in any case, the actual ritual has to do with like creating talismans and doing incantations and stuff like that. But you can't do any of it unless you've been specifically prepared in a very specific type of house, which we'll talk about later.
But again, after all this, you get to command angels.
Yeah, you get to command angels. And
pretty cool.
Again, in Crowley's mind, those angels are the secret chiefs. This operation is meant to reveal knowledge, which, spoiler alert, it will. Oh, baby.
So when does the devil come in?
We're making our way.
I was hoping for demons. Where are we? What are we doing here?
We're making our way. We're making our way
assuming he performed all this correctly and then was...
Whoa, you're getting way ahead of yourself.
Again,
it takes him like 3 years at least to do this.
Okay.
So we've got a little bit of time we're
going
to cover before then. Just a little bit of time. But just as a little teaser, after you invoke the child, the following 7 days consists of invocations of spiritual forces, both good and evil, subjugated to the will of the practitioner. These spirits consist of the four great princes of evil, their 8 sub-princes, and finally their 316 servants. Then the magical energies of these beings are bound to specific talismans, which will allow their powers to be used by the practitioner itself. So that's what Crowley's going for here. How does he go for it? Well, once he's back in London, he takes out an apartment under the name of Count Vladimir Svarev.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is interesting. He didn't want it tied to himself.
So there's the idea when you're performing this operation that basically all of the powers of the universe are going to like rally against you to stop this from happening.
Naturally.
So one of the most powerful powers of the universe is, of course, your mom. And so Crowley did this so that his family would not try to track him down and stop him from performing his magical rituals.
Okay.
That's his...
Odd.
That's what he
says. Yeah.
That's his explanation. The other thing that he says, they say, okay, so why would you not call yourself like Mr. Smith or some crap?
Right. Something that's super common.
So Crowley claims... And plant another flag right here, just like we did before with the Prime Minister. Plant one here as well. Crowley claims that he took the name of a Russian count for a few reasons. Firstly, he wanted a good opportunity to practice his Russian. And so he needed
still living in London.
Yep. But he needed to be in character to do so, basically.
So he's speaking with a Russian accent?
Yes.
I'm confused.
Theoretically, he is, for all intents and purposes, to anybody who doesn't actually know him, an actual Russian count living in London. Which also means... that this was his major explanation for choosing this. The language thing was whatever. But his main explanation is he wanted to pull what he called a social experiment to see how common folk, specifically like workmen, would react in the presence of a foreign dignitary whom they were not sure whether or not that the foreign dignitary could understand their native language or not. So basically he's trying to spy on the working class people to see if they think he's a dick. Which answers
the question. Yeah, yeah.
So he has this apartment.
Yep.
During this time, he also has Jones like teaching him directly. One of the things that he teaches is the process of astral projection.
That's cool.
Have you ever done it?
No.
Me neither. I don't believe anybody who says they have.
I haven't even, like, what's it called when you, like...
Lucid dream?
Yeah, I haven't done that.
That I've done, like, once, and it was awesome. That I believe that people can do. But people talk about astral projecting all the time. And I don't, and maybe it's just the people I hang out with, or not even hang out with, but I read about.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
And they're like, I can astral project. And I'm like, no, you can't. Don't lie. Can't believe this. Crowley could astral project, apparently.
Cool.
Now, for anyone who doesn't know what this word means, bless you, and I'm envious. But basically, astral projection is like separating your soul from your body and then flying around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a almost psychic.
Yeah. Journey.
Personification, yeah, of you, that you're able to go and visit places and see stuff and interact with others.
Yeah. As a soul, while your body hangs back. Hangs
correct.
Tight, as it were. Now, Jones.
That'd make travel so much cheaper.
Jones taught Crowley astral projection, and Crowley kicked Jones' butt at astral projection. Now, the process of projection.
I'm over there. Can't you see me?
Can't you see me? I'm over here. The process of projection includes the creation of a magical circle into which one would create an astral form of themselves, essentially visualizing oneself and then placing their consciousness in this astral body.
Just minus about 10 pounds, right?
Exactly.
Okay, perfect. Perfect.
And then once your consciousness has been transferred from your physical body to your astral body, then you just let it rip. Then you're just off. You're just like, and go away. You just think yourself up, I guess. I don't know.
I'd assume that's what Superman does.
Yeah. 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 Is Superman astral projecting?
Well, who knows?
Probably.
Find out next week on the Not Alone podcast.
Nope, we're not going to cut there. Now, the body would be able to travel, or the astral body would be able to travel right where it wished, and as well as interact with spirits of all sorts as it did. So you're not just moving through the material world.
Right.
You're moving through the astral realm.
That
did
seems,
you see?
That seems like just double the amount of traffic.
Yeah, it is. Did you see Insidious?
No.
That's fine. They basically do this in Insidious where he's like going, you're like in this normal world, but then this normal world is also inhabited by like demons and there's weird stuff all over the place. So that's basically what's going on here. So Crowley himself recounted coming into contact with a hideous, deformed black giant that attempted to do him violence, only held off by
this is my swamp.
Only held off by the efficacy of his magic circle. And the magic circle is primarily like a pentagram.
Is it made of salt?
No, it's a pentagram that you trace in the air with a wand.
What?
And the wand.
That's it? It's not even like on the floor?
The wand is a sword. You can do it on the floor, I think. But primarily.
You just wave a like, sword around in the air?
No, it's a wand that you say is a sword.
Oh. So it's not a sword that you say is a wand.
It's a wand
that
you say is a sword.
It's a magical sword,
which is a wand.
Okay.
Yeah. So he, using his magic circle, he was able to subdue this giant evil
nerds
black ogre by invoking the Hebrew name of God. He was told that this was his own wicked persona, that it was the source of his evil power.
Who told him?
I don't know.
Does he not say?
It was either, I think it was like a spirit guardian scenario as he was astral projecting, or it was Jones. I'm almost certain it was like a spirit guardian scenario as he was astral projecting, though. Almost certain.
Man, this would be way better if LSD was a thing during this time point.
True. He subjected the evil side, the evil manifestation of himself, he subjected it to himself. But when given the opportunity to destroy it, he refused. Because he saw its brute strength and terrifying power that he thought he could control.
Yes. Turn to the dark side.
Good. Such experiences, chronicled in Crowley's journals and shared with Jones and Baker, assured them that the time had come for him to join the organization for which they had been grooming him, the Golden Dawn. Dun, dun, dun. Anybody who knows anything about Crowley knows this is a big part of it. This is like the first big part. This is like, you probably were listening to this thinking we'd start here. Hell no.
If only.
You gotta make it through 2 hours of backlog first. That's the Not Alone way. We can't just talk about things. That's preposterous.
So anyway, the Golden Dawn.
The Golden Dawn. Or, as it's known properly, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
Something we'll never see, because we'll never leave this room.
Was a three-tiered occultic society officially founded in 1887, which claimed to be founded on the principles and rituals of Rosicrucianism.
Interesting, that's 1 year before the Jack the Ripper murders.
Huh.
Wild.
Why could that be? Maybe Jack the Ripper was a magician.
Maybe that's
and
how
it
he got away.
And it was human sacrifice. Ooh. Now, the source of the Golden Dawn is a collection of 60 mysterious pages referred to as the Cipher Manuscripts, so named because they were, of course, written in code.
Perfect.
It couldn't have, you couldn't have just written a normal charter. You have to make it coded.
Well, I mean, like, that's very, like...
extra?
I mean...
childish?
All, like, the alchemical societies were doing it. So why not?
I agree.
If you're in a secret society of some sort, I agree completely. It should be ciphered.
These manuscripts were purported to have been written around 1809, although they contain anachronistic information that places their true time of writing most likely to sometime after the 1850s.
Those are lies, Sam. Stop spreading
maybe
lies.
Maybe even 1887 itself.
Don't.
The writings were bequeathed to one Reverend Adolphus Frederick Alexander Woodford.
Frederick, huh? Interesting.
The Honorable Rafwa, if we make a acronym out of his name, a war hero and a Freemason, to another Freemason named Kenneth R.H. Mackenzie. They were bequeathed to him around 86. Mackenzie was unable to read the work, obviously, and so he didn't do much with them. Then on his death, or shortly before his death, depending on the story, gave them to William Lynn Westcott, another Freemason, who finally decoded them in 1887. Once decoded, the manuscripts end up as the instructions as to the rites of initiation for a society dedicated to performing the magical rituals of the Rosicrucians. It described a hierarchy which was organized around the Kabbalistic idea of the Tree of Life, or the Ten Sephiroth, which we're going to talk about a lot next episode. The documents also contain the contact information for one countess, Fräulein Anna Sprengel of Germany. That wasn't German. The secret child of King...
None of this is. It's all English.
The secret child of King Ludwig I of Bavaria. Westcott, as you might imagine, was delighted. He reached out. Yay!
He did it.
I found a secret society. I'm going to make it. Woo!
Okay.
Everybody's going to come to me. I'm going to be the dad. They're going to be my magical babies. That's what was going through his mind. He reached out to a number of other Freemasons to help him work the findings of the manuscripts into actual step-by-step rituals and ceremonies. One of these men who helped him was Samuel Lydell McGregor Mathers.
Interesting.
What?
Samuel. And we have a Frederick.
Oh, no. McGregor Mathers, as he's known for shorthand, or just MM, or just Mathers, but he prefers McGregor, as you'll see here in a moment.
M&M?
No.
Oh.
He was the translator of the Secret Book of Abramelin, and Mathers then brought in a man by the name of William Robert Woodman. These three men constitute the three founders of the Golden Dawn, and it is worth noting that these three men were originally part of another Rosicrucian society, referred to as the SRIA, or Societas Rosicrucia in Anglais, the Rosicrucian Society in England, which was established in 1865. Now, this society was only open to Master Masons and was similarly three-tiered. In it, in turn, is thought of as coming from another similar society operating in Scotland, which came from yet another earlier Rosicrucian group operating out of Germany, and so on, so forth, ad infinitum.
Okay, so we have these little sects of Rosicrucian societies everywhere.
Yes, yes. The SRIA, which was only Master Masons could join the SRIA, then gave birth to the Golden
Dawn. So it's a society inside of a society inside of a society.
Yes, very good.
It's the evolution of a society.
Yeah.
That is secret.
It is very good.
Well, once the secret's out, you got to make a new secret, right?
You do. You can't not have a secret.
Perfect.
That's how secret works.
Unless you're Sam.
True. I can't keep any secrets.
Perfect.
Now, Westcott, having worked out the rituals by the help of Mathers and Woodman, wrote to Countess Sprangle in 87 and asked for her permission to found a temple, practicing the hidden arts described in the cipher manuscripts. She, although theoretically these were written 82 years previous.
Wait, what was her command again? Why did they have to get her permission?
She's like...
Is she funding them?
No. No.
Okay.
No. From the manuscripts, they found that she is the head of this organization in Germany, basically, or operates as the representative for the heads of the organization. Thus, in order to
Wait. Are these the same things that got
These are the
deciphered?
Cipher manuscripts, yeah.
That are from...
1805.
Right. And it's
theoretically.
1887.
Yep.
And they... How old is she?
Who knows?
Son of a gun.
So basically, you get this idea of a direct spiritual lineage.
Right.
Even if you know everything, if you do not have the blessing of the predecessor or the head of the organization and you set up
then
your own symbol, you're illegitimate.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Got it.
So Sprangle was the only one who could confer to them legitimacy. Now, it's worth noting, I said that her contact information was found amongst the cipher manuscripts. I do not know whether it was that, like, it was written in the original manuscript or if someone had appended, like, a post-it to it and been like, you know, over time, we found this person. So it's a little weird, but it's possible, I guess. Now, Sprangle accepted and thus legitimized the Hermetic Society of the Golden Dawn in England. The lodge would be christened the Isis Urania Temple, or the Third Lodge, in London in 1888. Now, the first lodge was the one in Germany directed by Fraulein Sprangle. The second one was a failed attempt that had been... Why did I say this? The second one was a failed attempt that had been attempted but failed in London.
A previously failed attempt in London. Got it.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, the story is almost certainly false one way or another. There is no external record of any countess... The manuscripts were written in the hands of, or in the hand of Mackenzie, but so be it. Here we are now. The Golden Dawn distinguished itself from other Rosicrucian societies, or at least the SRIA and its lineage, fairly dramatically off the bat. For one thing, you didn't have to be a Mason to join. For another thing, you didn't even have to be a man.
Excuse me?
I know. It's a shockingly...
What tomfoolery is this?
It is a shockingly egalitarian society.
Wait, but if you previously had to be a man, why is a countess leading the one in Germany?
No, you didn't. The SRIA, you had to be a man. But Countess Sprangle, she wasn't part of the SRIA.
She was running a lodge in Germany.
Of the Golden Dawn.
Okay. So the Golden Dawn isn't a part of the SRIA. It's an offshoot, sort of.
It's another branch to a spiritual successor.
Okay.
Yes. Good?
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're almost there. Hang with me here.
I'm doing my best.
Now, the order did fairly well for itself right off the bat, attracting heavy hitters in British high society and running through the secret society circuit on word of mouth. One of the most famous members of the society, other than Crowley would eventually be himself, was the poet W.B. Yeats, known to poetry students and intelligentsia everywhere as simply Yeats. Yeats. I didn't even think about it until I'm saying it out loud. Yeats.
Yeah. Did he come up with a phrase?
I'm dead. This is killing me.
Oh, good.
The three co-founders were quickly whittled down to one. Westcott, who again was kind of the primary one in all
was
of this,
murdered.
Nope.
No.
He was appointed to the position of Supreme Magus or Magus of the SRIA after the death of Woodman, who had formerly held the office. So Woodman died very quickly.
By murder.
Yes. No. Sorry, no. Oh. Westcott then took his position and just said, you know, I could probably do both of these. But
it's a lot. That's a lot on the plate there.
Someone, probably Mathers, pinned instructions to a ritual to a carriage that Westcott was using, and his employers found out about the Society of the Golden Dawn. They told him to take a step back as, quote, a coroner should bury bodies, not dig them up, unquote. That's right. He was a coroner the whole time. Ha ha. I tricked you all by forgetting to mention that in the notes sooner. Sorry. Westcott agreed and took a step back from the Golden Dawn, but remained the head magus of the SRIA. Now, in 91, the contact with Fraulein Sprengel ended, and Westcott claimed that she was either dead or whatever, but the now nascent society was on their own either way. This was a problem because of the alleged source of the cipher manuscript's information. According to Westcott, or Sprengel, this information had come directly from a group that Westcott, or Sprengel, referred to as the Secret Chiefs. There they are again. The Secret Chiefs.
I was waiting for it.
We found
they would
them.
Return.
Now, again, it's very murky. It's always been and always will be very murky as to what these Secret Chiefs are, who they are, or what they mean. But the idea of the Secret Chief is very, very, very much akin to what we have covered before in our series, or in our show, as the Ascended Masters. Now, we've spoken about them briefly when we were talking about George Adamski and Ashtar Galactic Command, which was episode 3 of our Aliens in the Cold War series. Essentially,
forgot about that.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure you blacked it out.
Yep.
Essentially, the Secret Chiefs, or the Ascended Masters, or whatever you want to call them, are spiritually evolved beings who exist as physical conduits to the divine, or spiritual, not physical, conduits to the divine. Sprengel either was one of these people, or was in contact with them, who only ever communicate through telepathy in any case.
Naturally.
Yes. You can't not.
Why not astro project?
You'd think so, but it's not. It's telepathy.
Okay.
Thus, her passing cut off the Dawn from its fount of mystical knowledge. It was said that a final letter was received by the Golden Dawn, written by the associates of Sprengel, who told them that they had never wanted her to authorize temple work to be done in England to begin with, but deferred to her out of respect. Now that she was dead, they could expect no more help from Germany, and the information that had been given ought to enable the society in England to make their own connection with the Secret Chiefs. If not, it simply proved that they were never worthy of the knowledge at all.
Ooh.
It's a burn. It's a magical, mystical burn. But do not despair. Because where others have failed, a Scottish wizard king will succeed. As we return next week for part 3 of our series on Aleister Crowley and his magical mystery tour.
Yay, magical mystery tour.
Magical mystery. So yes, we'll talk about this wizard king next week. We're going to keep his identity under wraps. He's Scottish. He's a wizard.
And a king.
And a king.
That should narrow it down.
That it would. And if you, I'm almost certain.
Type in magic.
Type that into Google.
Scottish wizard
king. Let me see what happens. I'm almost quite certain that there's only going to be one response. Oh, I messed that up.
Bravo.
I know.
Already proud.
You didn't think you could until you did. Scottish wizard king. Oh, no, there's a few different. Oh, no, okay. Okay.
Look at that.
We're good, okay.
Homework.
So you'll never know who I'm talking about
until
next week. In any case, Jason.
Samuel.
How'd you feel about this? How do you feel?
My head hurts.
Yeah.
My head hurts.
I think that's fair.
I feel like the majority of this was establishing a secret society and then establishing a secret society and making it legit to some degree and then being a secret society.
Yeah, you were right. Secret is the secret society is the main word.
Correct.
This episode itself is a little light on the Crowley. He doesn't do much this episode. He kind of just stands back and lets context erupt and embrace him. As it will continue to do so.
For us.
For us. For a while.
The warm embrace of context.
I
can't wait.
As I was writing these notes, there's actually a point, I hope we'll reach it by the end of next episode, where I literally just had to type out, enough with the context. Can we please just talk about Aleister Crowley? So hopefully that'll happen.
Sure
but
did.
Next week, we're going to be talking about not only that Scottish Wizard King, but another one of the very, very, very important mystical, magical systems that enabled the Golden Dawn, Crowley, everybody to engage in such frivolous magical pursuit. So,
oh, so exciting.
Come back next week, part 3. Jason?
Sam?
Anything else?
I don't particularly think so.
All right.
You can always reach out to us on the social medias.
Like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Just and if you don't, for if you don't,
podcast.
If you don't know where we are now, then
it's been like 120 episodes.
Then I expected better from you.
I guess I did too.
A little bit. So,
all right,
Sam. I said it last week.
Did you?
I did.
I know you did because it was an hour ago.
Yeah.
Remember, whether you're descending a glacier with a broken heart, or you're renting out a London apartment under the name of a Russian nobleman, you are not alone.